Thanks. All right, well, it's real thrill to be here. I haven't done anything associated with Kavli before, but as Rob mentioned, spent a lot of time as a student TA at the physiology course, and so I've been kind of hoping to get similar interactions here. I should say I'm trained as a biochemist and cell biologist, but I really try to think about kind of the fundamental physical principles that are operating in our systems. And so for this week, I'm hoping to consider new perspectives on our research. So what I want to talk about today, and put it in the light of evolutionary cell biology, are a few topics related to the flexibility of subcellular assembly and then how cell size changes in early embryo development. So I like to give a one-minute summary of the talk and maybe give give a few answers away up front, just so that we're all on the same page. Mike Lynch's talk yesterday really nicely illustrated some scaling laws in single-celled organisms. But what I'm going to try and pivot a bit and talk about multicellular organisms and specifically the large eggs and subsequent embryos, and kind of the constraints associated with this. So what we do is we look at large amphibian embryos. We try to measure size scaling relationships, and to determine cause and effect, kind of something unique we do is we try to build synthetic cells where we can tune size and shape in vitro. And kind of the larger goal here is that we're interested in how cell size can regulate intracellular assembly and function and how this leads to downstream consequences for the cell and the organism. All right, so you might be wondering why we should even care about embryos and evolution. I realize this is a big jump from single cells. Obviously, many of you in the audience study mechanics or other components of aspects of development. What we're trying to, in putting this in context, it's useful to think about a system where you have a large cell. And so I just want to briefly go through a couple things, one being the origin of multicellularity here. This is the colonial hypothesis. You'll hear more from Nicole King later in the course, so I'm not going to go too much into this. But the basic idea is that if you have a unicellular organism, it can form colonies, and then you can have specialization, for example, somatic cells versus a gonidia, like in Volvox. And then you eventually can end up with much more differentiated tissues, in the fly. So what's required during this process is that, unlike in single-cell organisms where you can replicate, where you can form a new organism just by replication, you have a life cycle in these multicellular organisms. And so I'm just going to focus on this right branch here, the idea that you have an egg, there's constraints associated with it, and you go through an embryo, and kind of what we're thinking about with this system. So this is an example. This is Xenopus, very rapidly developing from the whole right branch here, from the egg through the embryo, and then eventually we get the tadpole released. And what's really cool about this is all just from maternally loaded protein. So the energy at the start of this movie, you have all the components loaded in the yolk, and you get development from this, and there's no other nutrients taken up. And so there's important constraints that relate to the size of the egg, because you need to develop an organism that can feed immediately after this. So this is in contrast to, like, single cell organism like budding yeast, where you can simply replicate by going through the cell cycle. Obviously, there is regeneration in multicellular organisms. We can think about this as a form of replication. But basically, you need this stage. You need to go through an egg and an embryo in these multicellular organisms, and this puts constraints on what you can do evolutionarily. Okay, so, and this is just mentioning that you get specification by going through the embryo. Okay, so one interesting evolutionary trend, I'm being very general here at the start, that we can decipher from extant organisms is that there's a selection for egg size. So this is just showing somatic cell human egg and a Xenopus egg. There's a lot of variation in egg size, but what's clear is that the egg is usually much bigger, 5 to 10 times bigger than a somatic cell. And if this wasn't important, we wouldn't be seeing it. So there, as I mentioned with the frog, you need to preload in a lot of contents for an egg laid outside of the body. And actually, I'll show you a graph here just of egg sizes for different organisms. And all the placental mammals, for example, which can get growth, which can grow and get and be fed through the placenta, their embryos, their eggs are all around the same size. And then you have these exceptions, which I think are really interesting and require special adaptations, which is what I'm going to kind of briefly talk about at the beginning here. So I'm really interested in the biochemical processes and kind of the normal cell biology that needs to adapt to something like a giant Xenopus egg. So the first concept I want to cover is the idea that you need to adapt to both extreme cell sizes and a continuous change in cell size. So in cells that are rapidly growing and dividing, like in the early embryo, there needs to be kind of a continuous adaptation to cell size. Shown here, this is a little bit off the screen, let me suggest this, is spindle length as a function of cell size. And kind of conceptually here, what I'm interested in is, why do these structures change size at all? You know, as Mike talked about with thinking about single cell organisms and growth rates and energetic costs and demands, you can imagine this scaling with size, but why would a spindle be larger or smaller? Every cell is the same amount of DNA, and unlike an energy-producing organelle, you might not imagine that you would get scaling with size. So this is showing cell diameter reducing with time after fertilization and a reduction in spindle length. Other groups have also shown that other organelles adapt to cell size, so nucleus volume is reduced after fertilization in Xenopus. And Tony Hyman's lab has shown how centrosome volume scales with developmental stage and cell size.
Can you say the word spindle and centrosome?
The spindle is an apparatus for segregating, aligning and segregating chromosomes. It's built of growing and shrinking microtubule polymers. It's a structure that in a normal cell is about, you know, half the diameter of the cell, and is a machine for segregating chromosomes. Everyone probably knows what a nucleus is. The centrosome is a smaller protein assembly, but still very large. 1 micron in diameter is typical. And nucleates microtubules and is important for positioning nuclei and spindles in the cell. So these are kind of like core biological processes in the cell, as you might imagine an organelle. But these are large structures, and their dimensions are shifting with the size of the cell in development. Yeah, so I'm being very basic here at the start. I just wanted to introduce the idea that you need to adapt to extreme sizes, and then I'm going to try and go through an example with the spindle of how this mechanistically occurs and how evolution is actually playing on the size of the spindle. Yeah.
The centrosome is not a big concern.
Complex and cross organisms actually changing in size. Well, it's only in eukaryotes. It is changing in size with cell size. There's certainly variability to some extent between organisms, but I think you would be able to pick out a centrosome in a cell because of its spatial position relative to the spindle poles or the nucleus, and its function is conserved using gamma tubulin to nucleate microtubules.
But it's not a conservative structure the way like a nucleosome.
Oh, right, okay, so these assemblies are, you know, a nucleosome is 5 nanometers and this is a micron. So these
are quite a bit about this one. Shows up. Per allele shows up. They've done a huge amount of per allele.
Great. Yeah, but these are large protein composites. And so, you know,
they're very little size, and you can kind of make it bigger or smaller depending on what you need.
That's, I think this is a concept that maybe is relatively new in biology, is the idea that if you look at a tissue culture cell, you might think these structures are relatively static in size, but when you look across a huge range of cell sizes in the same organism, you see that actually they're scaling with size. And so that's, I think, a really neat question of how do you build that flexibility into the system? Yeah.
Does the size of the egg in placental organisms scale with like the time between conception and implantation or something like that?
On the previous graph, this is human, which is about 140 microns in diameter, and that's elephant. And so there's, because there's a, all the mammals are the same. They're all between 70 and 150. So there's about only a two-fold range in egg diameter. What's different in an elephant is you have a much longer gestation time, and then there's a higher rate of mass accumulation in the embryo per day. So you're starting from the same point, but if you integrate over a long period of time, then you can build a larger organism. The reason I just point these out that they're all very similar is that they're not laid outside the body, so they don't have to have all this energy and nutrients preloaded. Chromosomes do, okay, so this is important. When we, here's just a schematic, but when cells are changing size, every cell has to have the same amount of, has to have one full copy of the genome, so their haploid DNA content is the same. Chromosomes do scale, so this has been shown in Xenopus and in C. elegans, that you do get some compaction of chromosome arm length, but this is actually quite small relative to the entire size of the cell and the spindle, so I'm not gonna talk about that today. You can look at neat work from Amy Maddox and Rebecca Hild. But I'm going to be talking about much larger structures. Okay, and then I just to make sure we're all thinking about this correctly, of course, you know, things change size. Very large, what I'm trying to say here is that besides energetic demands, you have physical constraints on the assembly of these structures. And what's neat is that they're changing. So here's one thing that we would definitely expect is that their, you know, cost for making a gene would be similar. I'm just showing some work from Arjun Raj's lab. With the basic premises that as cell size changes, you have increased amounts of RNA, but that the concentrations of components in the cells are staying constant. But you need output to scale with volume. So if you're going to regenerate proteins in the cell, but you only have this one copy of the genome, you actually have to keep producing more and more mRNAs as you scale with volume. So these are just some things you would expect, some scaling relationships, whereas I think you're not always going to be able to predict why the sizes of structures inside the cell are changing. Okay, and then I have to just spend 1 minute talking about how you adapt to extreme cell size, and most of this is from Xenopus and from other people's labs. But when you get to be a really large cell, rather than thinking about continuously varying with cell size, if you're just one size, there's still these really weird new constraints that occur. And so gravity actually matters. Cliff Brangwine's group at Princeton showed this in Xenopus oocytes. They have a big nucleus, and there's these small protein bodies in them called nucleoli or histone locus bodies. And if you inhibit actin, so if you get rid of the meshwork that's present in this nucleus, then these structures all just sediment due to gravity. This is just 5 minutes, for example, at room temp. You just get these structures settling. So when you become really large, there's special issues. Tim Mitchison's group has shown that centering is really a problem in these very large cells. How do you find where the position of the boundary is? And I'll mostly skip over the stuff, but I think it's informative. Or I hope it's something that, you know, maybe you guys can tell me is actually not interesting. I should stop working on it. But diffusion is also a problem. This is something I really think about here. And Jim Farrell's group has done some nice work on the time to diffuse from the middle of the cell to the boundary, you know, scales with x squared here. And so it takes a really long time to move from one target to the other. But in these large cells, people have found trigger waves where you're activating nearby molecules with feedback loops like through CDK1, and this can propagate signal outward without having to have a single molecule move to the boundary. So these are a lot of different concepts. The unifying theme here is that you need to be able to adapt to large cell sizes, and these are some exceptional ones. All right, so as much as I find this interesting, my lab doesn't work on these specific questions. This is something we're really focused on, is cell size as a control parameter in biology. And I'm going to just tease this because we'll see if we have time to get to it at the end. All right, so that's probably enough introduction. What are we interested in? How are the sizes of these internal structures? How do they scale with cell size? Are these conserved trends? If you look at different organisms, do you see the same results? And can we use the I mean, the egg is a pretty special system, but can we use it to explain what's happening in normal cells or when cells get diseased? We see changes in the sizes of cells and organelles. So can we use this system as a way to kind of parse that? All right, so briefly on our approach, we just try to measure sizes of things in embryos. And then to, you know, to test cause and effect, it's pretty challenging to do in the embryo. So what we've decided to do is build kind of hybrid cells that are basically cytoplasmic material from a cell, but whose boundary we can, you know, the topology we can control, and then look at how this affects assembly. So I don't know if I'm going too fast or slow. I think I'm on time in terms of number of slides, but if I've been jumping, or I know we've gone through a lot of different types of biology so far, but I'm going to just focus on one thing for the rest of the talk, and that's using scaling the mitotic spindle as a test case. So this is just showing the dynamic nature of the spindle in a tissue culture cell, and it's, I'll play it again. In black are the aligned chromosomes being pulled apart. So this machine needs to pull the duplicated chromosomes apart to the edges of the cell, and then you can get a cell division to occur. So this is a really large machine. People have identified upwards of 500 different proteins that make up this apparatus. And, you know, size estimates are in the range of 10 gigadaltons or more. So we're not talking about, you know, even things that are like, you know, think about six orders of magnitude bigger than like, or five orders of magnitude bigger than a ribosome. So these are really large structures with a lot of material in them. And because of that, we can do pretty low resolution imaging and still get out a lot of interesting kind of quantitative scaling data on the system. So this is just immunostaining of spindles in the embryo. We look at tubulin and the position of the DNA. We can also look at nuclei or other structures. So what we've done is immunostain, as I mentioned here, and then look at potential correlations. So let's just show one of the first ones. Spindle length is correlated with cell diameter, and spindle length is also correlated with developmental stage. So we measure the pole-to-pole spindle length from the previous image. And I'm just plotting it here two different ways. So these are color-coded actually by developmental stage. So you can see these are kind of interconnected. But there's two very different interpretations of this data. So the first is kind of compositional adaptation. I would say this is like biology adapting on top of the physics of the system. And there's two premises here. In vitro or in cells, people have done screens or knocked out individual genes and found that that's changed, you know, the size of the spindle. And then we know during development there are some changes in the levels of proteins as you're going through development. So if you put those two ideas together, could a spindle assembly factor be kind of its levels be increasing, and that's giving you a graded drop? So this is an adaptation to cell size. It's not cell size managing spindle scaling.
I have a question.
Yeah.
So this is all in Xenopus, and there was different Xenopi or whatever it would be with different ploidy levels.
Yeah.
Are you going to talk about that?
I'll show a plot at the end just that we get very similar scaling results in Tropicalis, which is a diploid. It's a 2N20. This is a 4N36. This is an allotetraploid. We found that the amount of DNA does have an effect on spindle size, and other people have published this. To get really meaningful large changes from this, you have to go pretty far away from that. So if you look at like a newt that's here in California, Tarica terosa, its genome is about 10 times as large as Xenopus, and its spindles at the maximum are also quite larger. So there seems to be some constraints between how much material are in the spindle and how big the spindle needs to be. So I'll touch on it a little at the end. Sure.
So what would this look like if you plotted cell diameter versus spindle length
Sorry, that's just back here. So this is cell diameter decreasing as a function of time after fertilization. These are the individual stages, just not color-coded. And so you're going from a 1,200 micron diameter cell down to, in the region we're interested in, to one that's about 50 microns. Yes, Andrew.
So one thing that might be worth noting is I think there are probably two different mechanisms to regulate cell cycle stuff that you're talking about. But then beyond that level of regulation, there's also a regulation that has to do with balance of forces and number of chromosomes. So these will be your experiments in the 90s. You may want
right.
chromosomes to spin up.
Right. Yep. Yep. That is definitely worth mentioning, and that's the same in the Xenopa system. You can add spindle assembly factors, nucleators, polymerases, and you can change the length of the spindle. So the idea I kind of want to test here is that could cell size on its own be regulating the spindle? Not that we're going to ignore everything else, but just isolate that one piece. Okay, there's a lot of questions in there.
Yeah, no, I'm sorry.
Let me unpack the first one. We think the concentrations of the components in the cells are the same. So, you know, for the most part, you're going to be able to polymerize microtubules up to how many you have in the system, right, until you drop to some concentration. So you should expect that the total length of microtubules polymerized in the system will scale with the volume. But whether those microtubules are a certain length distribution is still an open question. All right, so basically this is what I want to contrast, two different hypotheses. The idea that there's some special program that has been used to evolve spindle length scaling in the early embryo, or that there may be some kind of intrinsic regulation where the size of the cell, either through mechanics like limiting spindle growth, where the volume is constraining or controlling the size of the spindle, and that this is necessary for development. And because, you know, Mike showed power laws yesterday, we'll show it for the spindle. This is the average data here at different stages. So, you know, cell diameter is being reduced, spindle length is being reduced. And there's a region where you don't get any scaling, where we see an upper limit to spindle size, but in this region, you have a third power between spindle length and cell diameter. I want to just mention something, because your first guess might be that this is simply some kind of isometric scaling. So these cells aren't growing to become the embryo. The embryo is, you know, already large to begin with, but you can think of it the same way. But I just want to point out a few things. Spindle length is not always coupled to volume, so above about 300 microns. So now this is really big, right? This was to the right of the plots you were showing. These spindles are not continuing to grow with cell size. This ratio of spindle length to cell diameter is not constant, and this is really important. When we think about this system, like microtubules and other things, we can understand that if the concentrations are the same, the number of molecules is decreasing. But there's other asymmetries. There's other things that are anisotropic. And that's like, for example, the concentration of DNA. Because every cell has to have the same amount of DNA, so its concentration is actually increasing as cells are getting smaller. So we can't always just think that everything is going to be linked to volume. These are all great questions. So I'm partly just going to come to what our data is, but in cells, the spindle, the nucleus is already centered in the cell, and when the nucleus breaks down, that's where the spindle forms. So you have centering automatically at the beginning. There is asymmetry, so you can have asymmetric cell divisions based on the position of the spindle. And then the spindle is growing outward. Was that your original question? So there's, you know, it's adding mass, at least in this system, kind of in an inside-out fashion. In tissue culture cells, you have an aster, two asters at the start, and they'll overlap to form this kind of football shape. But in this system, you have microtubules assembling around chromatin. So you're kind of just assembling mass, and it gets shaped into a football through the actions of, like, dyne, pneuma, et cetera. Yeah.
Size, then you would have seen each one of those little scatters.
So if you, I mean, this is on a, you know, this is a massive scale here. So if I show you the data on a linear scale on both, you still see the scaling trend within individual cells. And actually, that was kind of the first evidence we had that this model might not make sense, because in the same embryo, there's this variability in size. If every embryo says at stage 6 you need to be this size, all the spindles are going to be the same size regardless of this variation in size within the stage. So that was kind of the first hit for this model. Yes, Mike.
Yeah, I just wanted to bring up a general point. I think it's really like some of the questions that are being asked. So in evolutionary biology, a big scaling issue comes up all the time. You can start with a scaling of just different cells within an individual. And then you can think about the scaling of different individuals, sort of the mean value, with different genotypes in the population. And then you can think of divergence of species. Dan Edelman's one of the few people starting to think about this, but you know, a big question is the sort of physiological scaling predictive of what this is usually referred to as allometry,
right?
The scaling that you would see in an evolutionary time scale. It's just something I think is worth thinking about.
Yeah, no, this is a really key point in choosing the system as well. What attracted me to the early embryo, maybe I'll just go back to a picture of it. All the way to the start. During these early divisions, because this is maternally controlled, the chemistry inside the cell is actually very similar. And so we can think about the effects of size partly in isolation from so many of these other confounding factors. When you look at different sizes of cells within us, for example, different tissues, adipocytes, beta cells, you know, there's maybe 3,000 genes that are differentially expressed between those two cell types. And then when you move within between species, if you're going to compare a yeast to, you know, to Volvox, to an invertebrate, to a vertebrate, et cetera, there's these massive distances. And so I really like to focus in on a system where we understand the parameters. And then, you know, partly for this course is thinking about how this might apply more broadly. But I'll just say, for our system, that was the attraction, is that we could limit the number of parameters that are changing.
Yeah, it's not meant to be a criticism. I'm just raising the issue that, you know, if you did a certain change within your one organism, you know, a five-fold change in cell volume, you know, this other scaling problem. Now, if you took the same cell in different organisms and it doubled in size, would it follow that same scaling trajectory?
I'm going to show you some data for two vertebrates, for this other species of Xenopus in mouse, that shows that it's pretty close to the case, but there's always caveats here, so we'll get to that. Yes? Yes. So, the MBT, or the maternal zygotic transition, is over a much larger period of time. It's the full transition of these maternal transcripts and activation of the zygotic genome. But, you know, MBT is considered around early to mid stage 8. No, but you have a complication, because once you start turning on hundreds of genes, then how do you know that size matters at that point versus, you know, the hundreds of genes that are being activated? So, yeah. I mean, there's many factors that change at that point. What I'm showing here is only up through the MBT. And I can show you scaling data beyond that, but it's harder to interpret. And it's the same problem actually in the mouse embryos, because ZGA happens so early, a lot of the scaling is linked together with these transcriptional events. Yeah. So this is a great point. This is what we're really interested in, because mostly what's happened is that there are correlations, right? There's how this structure changes with this structure. Identifying mechanisms is very important. And second is, what are the consequences? So what's been postulated for the spindle, obviously if you're too large, you can't fit in a smaller cell. that seems obvious why you would need to shrink. But in a larger cell, if the spindle was too small, it's been shown that there are kind of erroneous cell cycle effects in mouse oocytes associated with having a spindle that's missized. So your polar body extrusion is slightly messed up. This is in meiosis one. And there's other kind of models that if you're not big enough that maybe you won't properly segregate the DNA. So you're more likely to be sensitive to errors in the position of the cell division plane. And then other organelles are different, like the nucleus. Changes in nucleus size are associated with transcription. So the nucleus scaling we see in development is linked to kind of activation of the zygotic genome and other things like that. So each organelle is different, or each subcellular structure is different. But yeah, we're really excited about kind of the idea of cell size controlling these structures, and then what are their consequences. Yes? The egg is a really interesting case. Xenopus egg is around 1,200 microns, but the spindle is only 40 microns in diameter, and it's not in the middle. It's right up against the cortex. And this is for the second polar body extrusion. So there's these interesting asymmetries in those systems. Is your question, why do you not keep growing if you'd have a larger egg? I mean, partly you see that we have this plateau. Yeah, that's a great question. So I'd say this is a semi-active area of research of understanding, number one, why there's a plateau, and two, why it's not problematic for the cell. I'd say the main thing with the spindles, you think about positioning. It needs to be positioned in the center to properly segregate DNA. But the positioning works quite well, even with a small, a 60 micron diameter spindle, even having to span another 1,000 microns. So something about the system works that doesn't require to be larger. Why it plateaus could be that you can only, there's some physical limit to how large a spindle can grow, maybe related to aligning DNA on the metaphase plate. So there's some interesting theories there. Okay, the last thing I should just mention, this is spindle volume scaling with cell volume. And I bring this up, you might imagine in an equilibrium situation, particularly let's say for a single cell, like growing twofold, that you have this homeostatic relationship. So like a spindle length is gonna stay some fraction of the cell length, or the spindle volume is gonna be 4% of the cell volume. And we would expect that's probably gonna stay relatively constant. That's just kind of shown up here. And in the embryo, you start with, the spindle's only a tiny fraction, 10 to the fifth of the volume of the cell, and it's slowly moving towards this. So these divisions are getting you closer to what you see in a somatic cell, but you have this range where, you don't have a constant fraction of the cell making up a spindle. All right, and I should just mention these are all correlations. So what's important, or maybe why I'm here to talk about this, is that we're trying to dig deeper and understand mechanistically how this is happening, what's cause and effect. Within the context of development. All right, so I'd say, based on what I told you, there's kind of three hypotheses we were trying to work through. The first is that you need a developmental program to scale spindle length. The second is that cell diameter is mechanically limiting growth. So the spindle is growing inside out, and it's, hitting the boundary, and this is blocking growth. Or perhaps that cell volume is intrinsically coupled to the growth of the spindle. So we're going to try and work through this. So a necessity, to determining cause and effect here is having a system in which you can perturb size. So people have microaspirated cytoplasm from embryos. This has been some cool work in mouse. So starting with a smaller embryo, how do these scaling trends look? And I'll show you some data from the Hiragi lab on that. Or used anilin mutants in C. elegans, which can give you different size embryos or cells. But there's a real limit, because none of these systems tolerate these massive changes in size. So, what ideally we would do is take one stage of development and make all of the representative cell sizes you see at every other stage and look at whether the scaling relationships are conserved. And so the way we do this is using a synthetic cell, which, you know, very conceptually is just a boundary, and then the necessary cytoplasmic components you need to carry out some function. For example, you know, spindle assembly. And actually, we have, you know, one of the originators of this system in the audience, Andrew Murray, who's talking next. And so one half of the equation is having cytoplasm. And the reason I'm telling you this is we're able to assemble structures in vitro, so we can then ask, what's the effect of putting a boundary around them? So eggs from both Xenopus laevis and Tropicalis can be collected and fractionated. From the cytoplasmic layer, you can add an external source of DNA. So imagine this like fertilizing the egg. A sperm comes in. In vitro, we have the cytoplasm from this egg, and we're putting the chromatin, the DNA from a haploid sperm nucleus into the system. And if we kind of trick the system with calcium addition, like it's being fertilized, then you're able to form an interphase nucleus. This is happening in vitro. This is happening without a cell boundary. Basically, the biochemistry of the system is able to carry out the cell cycle in vitro. And then if you cycle back into mitosis, you can form a metaphase spindle after nuclear envelope breakdown. So you can do a lot of the things that are happening in the early embryo in vitro and without boundaries. What's important is that structures like the spindle reach a stereotypic length. So they, in this unencapsulated cytoplasm, they have a certain size. So then you can ask, what's happening to that size when you encapsulate it? So the answer is actually no, but it's close. So in most organisms, the meiotic spindle, which is what's in the egg, is a it's a spindle that's, the egg is sitting in the organism for quite a long time, and it has a spindle pre-assembled and poised, ready for this polar body extrusion. So the extracts make a spindle that's that size. Depending on the organism, that meiotic spindle is very similar in length to the first mitotic spindle, or it's not. So in C. elegans, there's a huge difference in size. In Xenopus, it's about 40 versus 50. So we're working from this developmental stage. We can also make embryo extracts, like from the 2 or 4 cell stage, and we actually get similar trends, which I'll show you about in a few minutes. Yes?
So without the cell membrane, I mean, what happens in this case? I mean, it starts, you know, dividing the DNA, right, and segregating it. And then what happens after this, though, I guess?
So in this case, they're arresting in metaphase, so we're not going through anaphase. If you add more calcium to the system, you can get chromosomes to start to segregate with anaphase A. The second part of anaphase is being connected to a boundary and pulling the poles apart. And there's no boundary, there's nothing to pull apart, so they just stop, you know.
Okay, so it's sort of go to the end of the system.
Yes. In the back, sorry. So one comes with the sperm nucleus. It's an interesting question in the system. So you can get rid of centrosomes in the system. What we're forming first is largely a meiotic spindle, but because we're going through interphase and duplicating the centrosome, then you find, a percentage of the structures have both centrosomes. But the spindles that form, they're not in anaphase, so they don't have these giant asters like you see in a cell. If you go, so it is a mitotic spindle at this stage, but we're starting with an extract, like the egg extract that's actually arrested at meiosis II. So its characteristics are partly meiotic. Basically, every cell division after fertilization, you get further and further away from that meiotic state, but you don't just switch immediately chemically to being mitotic. You're mostly mitotic.
My question was also because so far you discussed mitotic spindle scaling.
Yeah.
Which often is also related to centrosome
scaling. Right. Oh, that's a good point. So, right, Tony Hyman's lab has shown nicely that centrosome size is correlated with cell volume, set by cell volume in C. elegans, and also that this is correlated with the size of the spindles that are formed. So we haven't, and another group who studied the system has not found centrosome scaling here. But what's nice about this is these spindles can still form in the absence of centrosomes, so we can ask some of these scaling questions in a really minimal system. I'm never going to claim that we know everything that's happening in the cell, but I think some really neat things fall out when we just build a minimal system. This is really what I love about reconstitution. and ask if we can recapitulate qualitatively some of the behaviors we see in the cell. Yes?
So I apologize. Leading that question, we don't know what counts.
Yeah.
And so you use the term size and you use the term length. So to me, those are two potentially different things.
Yep.
Right? I mean,
yep.
So if it was just length but not breadth,
right,
then it'd be a very, very thin thing. The other question, maybe I can explain it together, I hope, is centrosome scaling.
Yeah.
When I think of the centrosome, I think of a body that is, or a single molecular protein machine that is homologous or identical to a basal body, a single basal body. When you talk about centrosomes, is it multiple basal bodies, or is it a single basal body that's getting very, very large? Which Lego pieces, how would you make a scaled thing that you're talking about?
Okay, so the first question is about dimensionals, which dimensions are scaling in the spindle. So both length and width are coming in. So it's, the football is largely shrinking isometrically from this very large state to a smaller one that looks somatic. It's not exactly like that. The width is scaling a little, is less steep. When I'm mentioning length versus volume, the idea is if a spindle has a length and if it has microtubules that are probing the boundary, it may sense the shortest axis of the cell. Like, it's growing out and it can find whatever the dimensions of the cell are. So if the cell is smaller, that it will actually grow to a smaller state. So that's kind of the length piece. And the other side is volume, the amount of molecules in the cell. Would that spindle be smaller if there was less material in the cell? So I'm sorry if I didn't kind of say, I know we're jumping through a lot of different biology. So then the other piece is a centrosome. What's it made up of? So, you know, it's largely structurally coiled coil proteins, and we're talking about something that's a micron in size. So it's many different proteins that are assembling together. The basal body is largely a centrosome. Does anyone want to correct me here? What are the major differences between a basal body and a centrosome? Andrew? Put you on the spot. Oh, sorry. Okay, so right, the two centrioles in the.
Yep.
So the centrosome is the centriole plus extra stuff.
That's right, and the scaling. Yeah, question.
So I guess when you do this experiment, the complex HEC1 that mediates interaction between the kinetic core and the microtubule, is that just ubiquitous enough? Does it happen prior to cytokinesis? If you don't have a boundary, I guess, to have a whole concentration of particularly close, I'm just curious, is the complex that mediates the interaction between microtubule and kinetic core?
Just everywhere? Yeah. So. Actually, that's basically the easiest way to think about this system is biochemically the cell cycle is being driven by the levels of cyclin B, CDK1. So, you know, phosphorylation, degradation in the system is driving the cell cycle, but you have components everywhere. And there are some spatial gradients like microtubules assembling around DNA and other things, but, you know, there are intact kinetic cores. But a lot of the spatial constraints related to the cell have been stripped out. And actually, you can strip out kinetic cores in the system because you can still form a spindle around different types of DNA, just like bacterial DNA on a bead. So there's these self-organizing principles in the system that can simplify it a little bit. All right, so one half of the synthetic cell is cytoplasm. The other half is, you know, creating a boundary. We've taken advantage of, you know, some old technology, droplet microfluidics, to where we can encapsulate an aqueous solution with a lipid monolayer, and we can control the chemistry. And, you know, by changing the flow rates and the channel size, we can make these cell-like compartments that are the same size as you would see in the embryo. So we can recapitulate all the sizes you see in the embryo, but we can decouple it from development. We're going to take one developmental stage and then test it with all kind of cell sizes. And we can control shape with compression. So this is the same data I showed you before, but in a slightly different fashion. This is spindle length as a function of cell diameter. The first 12 division stages 1 through 8 in Xenopus. You can see the scaling trends. You know, spindle length is reducing along the cell diameter. And you know, what was exciting is when we did this in vitro, looking at spindles assembled inside of these synthetic compartments, metaphase spindles, that we got very similar scaling trends. So we see spindle length reducing with droplet diameter. I shouldn't call this linear scaling, but you have this scaling regime. You have a maximum size, which is quite similar. And actually, they reach the same minimum size in vitro, which I think is a neat phenomenon. We actually can't get spindles smaller than this in vitro with compartment diameter. The embryo can do it because it's able to turn on zygotic transcription. So you're changing the chemistry of the system, and it's able to get smaller than this. So there's kind of a lot of interesting ideas with force balance on minimum spindle size, and what are the genes that might be turning on. So here's the same data, but just the averages and the power law. So you can see that in vivo and in vitro, you're getting relatively similar trends. I've ignored the plateau points and just, you know, fit to the linear range here. And so what this is suggesting is that cell size is directly regulating spindle assembly. Two questions. Go ahead, in front.
The data on the right is the stuff you showed earlier, right?
Correct.
Okay.
Just a clarification on my question. But in egg cytoplasm, you are not post-fertilization. You are adding the sperm in vitro.
That's correct. In this data, this is all from the egg. We've repeated the experiments taking stage 4 and stage 8. And we also get scaling. There are some caveats because the system changes a little bit. But if you take stage 4, you get a very similar curve to this.
They can take the biggest spindles as well. So they can play the entire range.
Stage 4 can make almost the entire range. They're slightly 10% smaller than what you get in the embryo. And this is likely related to pulling forces. So what we're missing, I mean, we have a cytoplasm encapsulated in a system. We actually use a pegylated surfactant, so we don't get interactions with the boundary. We really wanted to just study the effects. Well, it's giving it away a little bit, but we wanted to study the effects of volume. And so you don't have dyning at the boundary, pulling on microtubules, which will likely, you know, give a larger dynamic range. Another question, yeah? I mean, what I'll try and get to it in models, I don't know that thinking about the power law is the best way here, that we need to start from a different model for what would explain the, you know, the assembly from tubulin in the system and other components. So I just wanted to give it as context based on your talk and also just to show that these are similar. Yes? Yeah, we're recapitulating basically the same three things: a minimum, the scaling regime, and then a plateau. Yeah, it's a common question. I mean, I'm not going to speculate too much about it. I think the best guesses I have are that you can only incorporate so much material in the system with self-assembly until it's no longer, like, you can't, if you kept making a larger spindle, but you had the same amount of DNA, you'd be spreading your chromosomes across this massive, massive metaphase plate. Like, imagine, you know, a huge sheet like this, and there's chromosomes randomly spaced around it. So I think the integrity of the system could break down if you have too large of a spindle. That's a terrible answer, but that's one answer. Okay.
And my impression was that there's some surprising things, even like a very simple process. So, like, I remember hearing a talk from Guy Condit.
Okay.
Of like building sort of linear chains of things. And it wasn't obvious to me. So I wonder, you know, whether it's simple models of just how these things are built up sequentially could make some prediction on something like that. And like maybe that's what's setting, there are limits from that, and that's what gives you this plateau.
It'd be great to talk more about that, I mean, we've done a limited amount in this system, but you know, I'm definitely excited about this result that we're outside of an embryo, we're outside of a normal developmental program, and if we just change the size of the compartment, we can get, you know, very similar scaling trends to what we see in the embryo. And so to me, at least, this suggests that cell size is something that's being exploited, or maybe early in evolution helped give these correct scaling trends in embryos, and then, you know, there's been a lot of other interesting chemistry layered on top of it. But cell size has a fundamental role here. Yes?
So in this system, the idea that like the centrosomes contacting something on the cell surface or something like that, none of those things can play a role in your system.
No, they could. So we have a spindle assembling. And if it's growing outward, it has some effective diameter, let's say, from these astromicrotubules. Once that is equivalent to cell size, you might imagine that you're going to have mechanical feedback. Yeah. That's kind of the second hypothesis we're about to test. There's another hand. Yeah.
I wanted to ask about the experimental system. Can you see failure to assemble in this system we have? And do you see increased failure as the size increases or something like that?
Yeah, I don't have the slide in here, but that was something we were really wanted to be careful about. So in the best case scenario, about 70% of the DNA that you put into the system assembles a functional bipolar spindle. You get the DNA properly aligned. The other 30% are things like half spindles or asters. They fail to kind of form bipolar spindle. That does change, but it only changes at the extreme end. So below about 35 micron diameter, then we get this rapid drop in the efficiency of spindle assembly until when we're at about 27 microns, it's below 2%. And what happens, you see over and over again, is that the spindle keeps wanting to elongate. So it forms kind of a mini spindle early, and the poles are being elongated. Someone mentioned force balance here, like in Pombe, you have these motors in the system Egg-5, Kinesin, pushing the poles apart. Those poles touch the boundary, and then the system seems to fail. So we don't think that's what's happening in the embryo, but it's at the point where the embryo switches from just having whatever the maternally loaded components are to turning on other things. And so my guess is if we added something that, you know, like TPX2, which can inhibit Egg-5, reduce sliding, if it's basically suggesting that the spindle always wants to reach some minimum size, and what do we need to change in the chemistry of the system to overcome it? But anyway, efficiency is not producing the scaling curve. It's only below 35 microns. Yeah.
So during this the initial scaling region, do the spindles grow? The poles grow always to feel boundaries, to kind of be in contact with boundaries.
No.
Then how do actually the spindles know the size?
That's a good question. I'll get to it in the next slide.
Maybe you should try that.
Okay. Well, one more question. Good. Is anaphase B scale with the size of the cell? I'm sure it does. Maybe as another example, I'll just give you that in C. elegans, the ring closure speed, cytokinesis, scales with ring size so that every cell division is happening in the same amount of time. So if you have a really big ring coming in, so it's kind of the same question as the segregating poles. You want it to happen in the same amount of time in the cell cycle. So probably the poles are being segregated more quickly in a larger, there's probably more dyning. I actually don't know if there's been a study on that, but my analogy is ring constriction is okay. So can we test, I'm not saying that there isn't a developmental program, that there are not a lot of proteins that can't regulate spindle assembly, but in a vacuum, if we ignore development, we still get very similar scaling trends. So Could cell diameter or cytoplasmic volume be one of the reasons we see these relationships? So to differentiate between these mechanisms, we change the size of the compartments. Basically, you always want to have a sphere the droplets formed spheres, but we can compress them into disks. So if we do this prior to assembly of the spindle in vitro, what happens to the scaling curves? So this is the data, spindle length plotted against either droplet volume or the diameter that we see when we're looking at it through an objective. And largely, we can ignore the curve on the right because everything is shown here. The spindle length scaling curves look identical or very close to each other when you compare uncompressed spheres versus compressed disks in this system. And what that means is that the spindle, regardless of the dimensions of the compartment, is assembling to some size. Dimensions in the sense of if we take something with the same volume and we change its dimensions, the spindle's not reading out the geometry. It seems to be reading out the amount of material. So we're doing that, basically think of any point along here. Take one volume and whether it's been turned into a disk or not, you get the same scaling trend. So the limits are, we don't want to constrain the spindle at all mechanically. Well, so the spindle has a certain width. So we didn't want to constrain it to where it couldn't assemble to its full size. So that's our constraint. Yeah?
So is the compression directional sensitive, meaning you compress it perpendicular to the orientation of the spindle versus you compress it horizontally in the directional direction? Do that make a difference?
We compress it prior to assembly.
Okay. And
the spindle is always aligned because their long axis is actually longer than the compression. So they're always oriented this way. Early, when they're a kind of a miniature spindle, they can rotate any way. But when they get stuck in the short axis, they turn. Okay, and again, this is meant to be illustrative as a minimal system, that we can get so much out of this just from a very basic system. Not that boundaries aren't incredibly important. All of spindle nucleus positioning, all of membrane transport, all of these things we're somewhat ignoring, but I think it's pretty neat that we can get these results without so many of those factors. Right, so what if we do a bunch of tricks to change the cytoplasm? So you can't dilute the cytoplasm. These extracts will not tolerate more than a 10% dilution. But what I found is that you can actually deplete total protein. So if you just put in beads and non-specifically bind to all the proteins and you make sure that you're not depleting certain subsets, you can drop the amount of protein but not the small molecules in the system. And those make smaller spindles. So we have a fair amount of evidence that cytoplasmic volume is really dictating the assembly in this system. And on top of that, there's going to be many other things like mechanical constraints pulling from the boundary. And molecules are going to be changing in embryogenesis. Not every molecule, every protein has the exact same concentration.
I guess I just have a comment because I've heard you give this talk before. And I feel a little bit like this is not aimed at you, it's aimed at the rest of the world. But the way you talk about your work, you're constantly hedging your bets because everybody keeps coming at you with all their different ideas.
Sure.
My thought sometimes when I listen to people giving you all their ideas is I want to see them write down the mathematics that's going to predict something rather than just saying vague words like, I'm not criticizing anybody here, but I'm saying, what about this, that, or the other thing? Because I feel like you've got a very concrete story in which you say, I want to control this parameter and see what happens. Get facts.
Well, I appreciate the support on that. I think why we need to hedge is that I think it's a little scary to think that this would explain everything or that we could not worry about the effects of boundaries.
Sure.
Or
you've got knobs.
We have knobs. We can, yep, we're going to add knobs, continue to add knobs to the system.
Okay.
We'll leave it at that, yeah. But thank you. Okay, so... Can you compress oocytes?
Yeah, well, I guess you're not going to get the volume.
Right, so the conclusion here is spindle length is set by cytoplasmic volume, not boundary position in this minimal system. So why does cytoplasmic volume set size? Why is this a control parameter in biology? And I'm going to run out of time, so I'm trying to figure out how to do this. But we took a guess that, you know, the major component of the spindle is tubulin, so we wondered, would the amount of tubulin run out in the system? And we don't even have to think about polymer dynamics at the start. We can just ask, if we just measure it, what is the distribution of tubulin in the system as a function of cell size? So we, you know, collected, measured the same things in the embryo, but did 3D reconstructions to where we could mask the boundary of the cell and the spindle. We're using, we have alpha or beta tubulin antibodies, so we're looking at all the tubulin in the cell, not just its polymerized forms. And so what is the distribution of tubulin look like? Which again is the major building block of the spindle. So if you plot cell diameter here, you see that if you divide the signal in the cytoplasm versus the total signal, it's not flat at any point, right? I mean, above about 200 microns, it looks like you're, these are in cells that have assembled spindles, I should say. So what we're wondering is spindle assembly depleting the available amounts of tubulin? And you can see below 200 microns, it starts to look like as cell size is reducing, there's a larger and larger fraction of tubulin being depleted from the cytoplasm. This is just a measurement. Where is it going? It's going into the spindle. That's just, you know, the math of the system here. And so this really kind of got us thinking about tubulin is, you know, is a 50% reduction in the available tubulin in the system going to be enough to drive this? So together with a postdoc in Dan Fletcher's lab, we developed kind of a relatively simple model to try and explain the scaling data. And there's kind of two key assumptions. The total mass of microtubules that can be polymerized in the system is dependent on the concentration of tubulin in the cytoplasm. And then the other thing is, you know, you brought up the question about width versus length. We're saying this football is staying relatively, its aspect ratio is relatively similar. But what about the density of microtubules or tubulin in the system? You know, you could make a bigger spindle with the same amount of material if you just had a lower density of microtubules in it. So we measured the density of microtubules, or of tubulin, excuse me, in spindles across this range. It looked relatively flat, around 280 microns. Other people have shown this as well. If you scale spindles in vitro in extracts by changing the amounts of like XMAP215 or other constraints, you always, basically the density of the tubulin in the spindle is kept constant because of like the spacing of motor proteins and other things. Okay, so then these are the basic kind of equations that we put together. This is just conservation of mass. Volume and concentration of tubulin is, if you just drew it out online, how much tubulin would you get? And then the total length that you're polymerizing is dependent on a proportionality constant, which comes from the EM data on the spindle, which basically a spacing of tubulin in the system. And we're saying it's dependent on the concentration of tubulin. We think about this if like at an equilibrium, this will be the remaining tubulin in the system, and then some minimum, with the idea that, you know, like a critical concentration. So we solve for spindle length. We use parameters from published literature, from our own measurements, and we get nice fits for two things. So there's a lot of stuff going on this curve, but spindle scaling is on this left y-axis. This data is in gray. And then what I showed you before, this what's the fraction of tubulin that's in the spindle versus outside in the cytoplasm. And so, you know, in larger cells, a very small percent of tubulin is in the spindle, and then as you get smaller, it goes up. So the experimental data is the points, and these are our fits. So we get nice fits with these parameters. And I don't know, I think it's pretty neat. I mean, it's a very simple model, and it would also work for any other component that's a part of the spindle. So we're talking about tubulin, but if you had a motor or another protein that was incorporated in the spindle, and you knew its concentration in the spindle and cytoplasm, then you should be able to predict, you know, similar trends for that. Those haven't been measured yet. We had the data for tubulin. So we think tubulin is one component that's likely becomes limiting to cell by cell size in the system to spindle assembly.
So do you think the plateau would go away if you increase the tubulin concentration in the cell?
So a couple things. This plateau, The caveats here are that we're not predicting this upper limit. This upper limit comes from the parameter beta, basically from the EM data. We know how much tubulin is in the you know, this football-shaped structure, and how it's spaced. And so if you say there's this much tubulin in the system and this size, it makes this size football because of the density of microtubules in the system. So that's where that comes from. So really this model is just saying, if you had an upper limit, what's the behavior you get? But I'm you know, encouraged by the fact that we can predict how tubulin gets redistributed. Yes? Of course.
Where did one third come from?
Where did what?
One third.
It's from solving these equations. Well, no, I mean, the geometric parameters are what's put on top of this. So, yeah, I don't know. What are you thinking here? Okay. Well, these are, you know, values that are known in. But yeah, I mean, you can vary the parameters and the fits will get better or worse. I'm showing what we used for the fit, but these data are not from fitting. Yeah. And just as a comparison here near the end, you know, this is the red lines are what you would predict with just the law of mass action. So in some ways, you know, we found that spindle size is set by the size of the cell, but we figured out what it was. It's not just the energy in the system. It's not the mechanics of the boundary. Well, it may be the energy in the system, but the relationship we identified to, you know, goes beyond just there's this, you know, power law here because the spindle is plateauing. We don't know why that's happening, but, you know, that's why mass action doesn't work. And then this is important. I mean, again, if you just think about an equilibrium system, you might imagine as you perturb size that you always have the same fraction bound, that what you incorporate in the spindle is only some constant fraction of the cell. And that's definitely not the case, right? We're using a very small proportion of the tubulin in the system to make spindles in large cells, and then you get towards that kind of somatic cell homeostatic state once you're really small. But you're very far from that in the largest cells. Okay, so basically, you know, how would you validate the model? This question came up. Let's alter the cytoplasmic volume and look at what the effects are. As I mentioned, the Hiragi lab did this with mouse embryos. So they sucked out 2/3 of the cytoplasm, let the embryos develop, and then looked at the scaling relationships, and the spindle scaling matched with cell volume, not with developmental timing. This is the gold standard here. This is something we're working on, but this is kind of the evolutionary concept, is that the size of the egg and the amount of maternally loaded proteins is what's specifying all this scaling that we see. So you could either think about, let's look at another organism that has a smaller egg, or try and make a smaller egg, which is what we try to do in vitro, or you could perturb the levels of all these factors. So if you could deplete a maternally loaded factor like tubulin or anything else, you would expect that that would be under the influence of evolution. That would be selectable if it was important, if there was a downstream function or consequence for needing to change scaling. So this is difficult to do, but this is something we're working on. I'm going to show you data for the third, which is, are these scaling trends conserved? So Dan Needleman's lab has some very cool data in C. elegans. I'm just going to show some kind of comparative data from the HEALD lab that was recently published. So this is looking at a bunch of invertebrates as well as vertebrates. Some really weird organisms in here, but what you can see is that you have this nice scaling of spindle length, pole-to-pole spindle length, with cell diameter. These are what's represented in the system. Just to focus in a little bit, because this is really broad, if we just look at vertebrates, these are things that I measured, and then this is data from the Hiragi lab. If we ignore the plateau, so I've gotten rid of the plateau in the Xenopus data, the Laevis data and the TROP and the mouse, these all plateau. So this is just the kind of linear region. they look, spindle length is correlated with cell size. And then, you know, from Dan's data, from this recent paper from the Niederlin lab, they looked at variation in different isolates of C. elegans, and they had a nice scaling of embryo size and spindle length. This is the length of the spindle at the first division. So there's some really interesting insights to come out of this. I think it's consistent. We can't say that cell size necessarily has an effect in every system, because in mouse, we have this scaling trend, but actually most of this data is after they've turned on zygotic transcription. So maybe they dispense with cell size dependent regulation and they use a bunch of genes to regulate spindle size. But Laevis and Tropicalis, these curves, they're happening largely in the absence of compositional changes to the cells in the embryo. So unfortunately, I didn't have time to get the data and fit it. So
it looks a bit more than one third. The prediction is one third of everything is followed, right?
Well, the question is it worth trying to fit the data to a one third power curve, or to think more about kind of the limiting component model that we built and whether these all fit to that? And then it's tricky, because is tubulin the same concentration every system? Is the density of microtubules within the spindle the same in every system? So once we really dig down in the details, it starts to become, I want to say that this can explain a lot, but you know, until we look at those parameters, this is just a good guess that this volume is probably controlling these as well. Yes?
So one thing that seems to fall out of this is that based on your math, suggesting that tubulin in systems where the only thing that tubulin is doing at the time of division is being in the spindle, then your law should work, right? But if the cell is doing other stuff, right? I'm thinking about, you know, cells that are dividing and trying to swim at the same time, or trying to swim to separate, then it shouldn't work. I mean, is it possible to use that almost as a proxy to see the cases you're saying? This is all really difficult to try and assess in details.
Yeah. How pleiotropic is tubulin usage in that system, and is that a significant depletion of the pool that it might affect the scalar trend?
Other, you know, going into other organisms, right? Does this only work for big embryos?
I see. So it definitely works for small embryos. C. elegans shows the same trends here, and they're 50 microns to start with, and then get down to 5 microns. I would say some data that I think supports the idea you're thinking about is in fission yeast. David Kovar's lab has looked at how actin polymerization, the types of actin polymerization that are occurring in the cell, and the amount of actin available in the cell. And actin nucleators dictates whether you have filamentous actin or you have these ARP2-3 dependent branched actin networks or foramen networks. So I think there's the idea of having limited resources in the cell is what we're working with here. And so anything that pulls from that limiting resource, like a swimming, using microtubules in a different way, you would expect would affect spindle assembly. That would be the prediction, basically. So finding the right system to really figure that out, maybe it'd be nice to talk about that.
Yeah.
All right, I'm gonna finish and just maybe pitch this. Thinking about how modeling would be useful here. We're really interested in reaction diffusion processes, so thinking about how those would be sensitive to size. I'm trying to build cell size sensors based on the surface area to volume ratio shift that occurs as cell sizes changes. And you know, this is something that I couldn't understand about the spindle system at the start, because I kept thinking everything in the system was scaling with size, but the DNA is not. The DNA was staying constant, and that was an important asymmetry to think about in the system. So I'm wondering how many other things I haven't thought about. So I'd love to hear your feedback, and certainly, you know, this is all work in progress. So please criticize away. All right, thanks.
Okay, so Matt, that was fantastic.